Nets series 1-0. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, May 31st. Sunny and pleasant. Today's high 73. Right now we're at 54 degrees under a sunny sky at 8:10. The Morning Show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we explore happiness.
I love long car rides, although I don't know why. I have restless leg syndrome and an annoyingly small bladder. I easily get highway hypnosis, and I almost always get lost. I like having our family together in one place, though, even if it takes door locks, seating restraints, and no safe exits to achieve it. We talk, we sing, and we argue. We've also listened to lots of great audiobooks over the years, and that's a wonderful way to take in literature. I've always loved reading aloud to my kids as well, but when I'm driving, I think an audiobook is safer.
And, of course, that unmistakable voice is that of Paula Poundstone. And it's someone many of you know, or you feel like you know, through her frequent appearances on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and on all of the other ways in which she brightens up our lives. And I'm really delighted to have Paula Poundstone on the phone with me to talk about her latest book, which is called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, in which Paula Poundstone explores with, in I think, just the right balance of hilarity and seriousness, what it means to be happy. And I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to speak with her about it. Paula Poundstone, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Hey, thanks so much.
Really glad to be talking with you. So tell us what the state of affairs was in your life about 7 years ago, which prompted you to start thinking about how you could be happier. I mean, how unhappy were you at that point in your life?
That it's that I was extraordinarily unhappy. I just was thinking that I wanted to find something that I could do that, you know, that that left me with like a residual feeling of happiness, you know? I mean, I do plenty of things that I enjoy, but what I wanted was something that buoyed me up during my regular day, you know, when I returned to it, when I returned to raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. So that was the point of the point of the experiments was twofold. The first point, I suppose, was to have the fun of writing. You know, I figured it was a great playground for writing funny stuff. And it was yet another memoir, which I get to keep writing because I'm not dead yet. So I would do the experiments, and as I was doing them, I would keep very careful and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written about what was happening, doing whatever the activity was, and then continuing to tell the story of returning to my regular life. And every chapter is written as a science experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and the variables and the analysis is usually the part where I return to my regular life. And, it took place over the course of 7 years. Unexpectedly, I didn't. But, you know, some of the experiments were something I would do in a day. Like, for example, one day my kids and I, we had planned this for a long time. We were sure this was going to be the key to happiness. We were going to watch movies for the entire day. And by the way, it wasn't. My my lower extremities ceased to function very early on from sitting in a chair for so long. It was good for having matted hair. If you wanted that, then it was just the thing to do.
You also mentioned that when you sent your kids off to the video store to rent what they wanted to see, that you said something about how they were inclined to choose their movies the way warriors choose weapons to inflict harm on each other.
Yeah, normally when we would watch a movie, and my kids were raised, we didn't watch television when they were growing up. We only watched a DVD or a video, but on a non-school night and only at night, never during the day. And so the idea of doing this was very exotic to us. And I have a huge collection of movies and old television shows on DVD and video. And so normally we choose from that, you know. But I foolishly, they hammered me into letting them go to the video store at the time to choose. And I swear my son went into the unwatchable section. He came up with some stuff that was so bad. I didn't focus on that until we went to put them in. You know, we took turns, you know, whose movie we were going to watch. And, his stuff, he's my youngest and the only boy. And the tastes run afoul of good taste.
Of course, some of these experiments in the pursuit of happiness were much longer experiments, like the very first one you tell us about, which is all about getting fit. That was a bumpy road, wasn't it?
That took months. I took Taekwondo and self-defense, and they were grueling workouts. I was up to, by the time I stopped, I was up to doing 500 rope jumps, and that, by the way, is in a row. It was absolutely grueling. Although it was fun doing the workouts, And it did have a lasting effect. I wasn't particularly good at it. First of all, there's a lot of right and left in. Who's also do this with your right, do this with your left. I can't tell left from right. I don't know why. It must be some sort of a learning disability, but I cannot tell left from right. So the only way I could defend myself is if an attacker came at me from the right and gave me enough time to pretend to eat. To see which was my right hand, in which case, you know, we're totally protected. But otherwise, not so much. But they were. It did leave me with a lasting. I'd wake up in the morning when I was doing the Get Fit experiment, and there were times where I would wake up in the morning and really feel filled with possibility, which I have to say is not. That's not me on average. One day I was walking down the alley carrying trash bags full of cat waste and kitty litter, probably about a good solid 30 or 40 pounds, I'll bet you. And all of a sudden I realized, I feel pretty good. And I thought, it can't be the cat waste, because I've carried cat waste down the alley before, and I never felt that good about it.
Right.
So I do think it was the residual after effects of working out. Some of the things I tried because other people thought it would make me happy. Like, I did rent a Lamborghini for a day, and I have to say that there were times where it was kind of sort of fun, but not a lasting anything.
Right.
Even when I was driving, there were times, I'm driving the fastest car I'll ever drive in the city with the heaviest traffic. So there were times I got up to, rip-roaring speeds of 20 miles per hour. but it just didn't, I don't know. You felt like a jerk driving it for the most part. It didn't fill you with happiness.
I remember at one point you said you would have enjoyed this so much more if you could have driven around in your Lamborghini in secret. I mean, without the rest of the world gawking.
Yeah, it's true. If it was just the act of driving the car, then it might possibly have been fun. It's just that it comes with too much baggage. Plus, every time you hit the gas, you feel it's like an oil embargo. You use so much. Normally, Well, at that time, I drove a van, a dented van, with echoes of family arguments inside, and Pop-Tart crumbs, and diet soda cans.
Not a Lamborghini.
Not a Lamborghini. In fact, one of the things I made note of with the Lamborghini right away, you know, I get in, I always carry a bag with me of, you know, sodas and water, and I turn to put my bag somewhere, and there is nowhere. Like, there's not a lot of space in a Lamborghini. And I thought, well, that's part of the reason people are happy driving it. You can't fit anybody else in.
Right. In the chapter called Get Wired, we have you describing yourself as this: I'm kind of Amish without the religious beliefs or the bonnet. You really began that chapter at a place where you were really very wary of the computer. It barely was touched. You didn't know how to use email or really anything that is so basic for most people. Tell our listeners a little bit about your effort to get wired.
I really was a blank slate when I came to it, which is sort of interesting. I mean, I didn't purposely, it wasn't intentional that it was that way, but it just was. It was one of the things that people kept telling me. You know, I had already written a couple of books, and people kept saying, "Oh, you'd love using computer. You know, it would make it so much easier. It makes life so much easier. It's so great to be to be online and connected," they would say. Now, we had a big computer in our house that my assistant used and my kids could use, but I didn't even know how to turn the thing on. So I went out and I bought a laptop, because a laptop you can bring door to door and beg for help, whereas the big kind you have to lure somebody into your house to help, which, let's face it, Jeffrey Dahmer ruined for everyone. So I went out and bought a laptop. One of the things that's interesting about the chapter is, because I was a blank slate, one really does see my sort of slide into the compulsions of checking things on social network or checking email once I learned how to do it. To the degree of losing sleep and losing focus on other things that are important, you really do see it as the giant time suck that it becomes for everyone who uses it, the difference being that most people had already been using it for quite a while at that point. And the other thing that's sort of interesting, and again, this was not by design, it just was what was happening in our lives. I foolishly put my son in front of a computer when he was 3 years old because I didn't know any better, and I believed I was giving him some sort of a leg up. And the girls were young too, but they weren't as young as he was. He ended up saddled with an electronics addiction and it is a real thing, and it just caused him, you know, an early lifetime of problems, and was, you know, really, really difficult for the whole family. But that ends up being chronicled throughout the book, you know, mostly comedically, but it was a real thing.
Right. Okay. And I want to say, I really appreciated how serious this book gets at certain points, especially as you're wrestling with certain real life issues. For instance, your beautiful daughter Tosha happens to be contending with cerebral palsy, and one of the really interesting threads in the book is your frustration with the low expectations that a lot of people would have for her, especially, for instance, her teachers.
Yeah.
And man, you had to really fight ferociously to get them to set the bar where it belonged for Tosha, in terms of where she...
And by the way, in a lot of ways, I was never able to get them to do all that they should have done. And we all, you know, we all, when you deal with somebody with a disability, you know, I certainly have been guilty of shouting at blind people before. You know, how you think, well, if they can't see, maybe they can't hear. So you just talk louder. And we all, no one wants to be the person to have asked more of someone with a disability than they could deliver. And so you immediately, and by the way, it comes from a kind place, not from a mean place, not from a rude place, but one has a tendency to lower expectations right away. Sometimes until you find, you know, your solid footing, until you gather, okay, now I know, oh my God, okay, she can't see, but she can hear, great, I don't have to shout, fine. Right? It takes a little bit. In the case of my daughter, Tosha, she had a tendency to play people. So it was very hard for anybody to figure out what her threshold, what her ceiling was. And honestly, I'm not sure. I still know for sure. she's a piece of work. One of the things I tell the story of is her at camp going on a ropes course.
All right.
And it was one of the greatest athletic feats I have ever seen in my entire life. And it came as a total surprise to me, and certainly a total surprise to the people who ran the camp. She's affected mostly in her legs, in her balance, she has huge upper body strength and no fear. That was the thing. You know, when she did the ropes course, she just had no trepidation. It looked like someone stepping on an elevator and stepping off again. It was an amazing thing to see. Right. And one of the chapters in the book is she and I go backpacking together. At the time, I didn't say in the book, I don't think, but at the time, I had a bad back. And she, of course, has cerebral palsy, and it was quite a trip.
Right.
At one point, I can't swear to this because I never saw it with my eyes, but I'm fairly certain that a bear came.
Well, you certainly saw a sign saying you are in bear country, which was actually not exactly what you were hoping to see. So
it was not. You know, I decided that we weren't in bear country anymore. I don't know why I decided that. But when I didn't see a flyer at this particular campsite saying so, and yet there were all these little squirrels around, and I didn't want them eating my Pop-Tarts, and so I committed a cardinal sin of backpacking, which is I brought the backpack with the food into our tent for the night. And somewhere in the middle of the night, some of the loudest snuffling I've ever heard in my life. And Tosha and I clinging to each other. We were, it scared the hell out of us. We were clinging to each other like Laverne and Shirley. And we had headlamps on. So every time we looked at one another, we blinded each other for a few seconds. We eventually, and I'm fairly certain it was a bear, but we eventually drove it away by we sang songs from The Harder They Come. And it's a little-known fact of nature, which is bears do not like songs of social struggle.
Well, we're glad you survived, because otherwise you wouldn't have lived to create this wonderful book, which, by the way, I've enjoyed in the audio version. So something like 6 hours' worth of Paula Poundstone filling my house as I cleaned my office. It gave me great pleasure. The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Paula Poundstone, thank you so much and best wishes. We wish you great happiness in the years ahead.
Thank you so much. It was nice talking with you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. It's exactly 8:29. We're going to keep talking about happiness, but this time in a little more serious fashion, with a guest I spoke to earlier this year, Ginny Sassaman. Her daughter, Jennifer Sassaman, is on the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And Ginny Sassaman, who lives in Vermont, was here in Racine for a few days in not only to visit Jennifer and her family, but also to do a happiness workshop in Racine. She is co-founder of an organization called Gross National Happiness USA and is licensed with a practice of positive psychology. So here is a portion of the conversation which we recorded at the time of Ginny Sassaman's visit to Southeast Wisconsin. Here she is explaining how she first got interested in happiness.
Well, I like to believe that I was fated to become a happiness expert because there's a family story about me that when I was maybe 18 months old and I was in my crib, the youngest in the family at the time, my mother says she heard me making noises and said, oh, I need to go see what the baby needs, and came in the room, and I was rocking back and forth saying, happy, happy, happy. So that, I think that's where it started, but then it was on a back burner for quite a few years.
Right.
It re-emerged. I actually got a master's in mediation. I was in my 50s, went back to school for that. And my master's thesis was about mediation and suffering. So I wrote and researched and wrote and researched all about suffering. And then after that, I picked up a book on happiness.
Hmm.
And then I just picked up another book on happiness. And really, from then on, it was off to the races. For me, the way in really was not through the door of personal happiness. That came later. For me, the most transformative moment in my life of moving in this direction came from a book written by a fellow public radio person, Eric Weiner, who was a foreign affairs correspondent at NPR for many years. He also got pretty burnt out on the suffering he saw, so he decided to research the happiest countries. And there is data. There's lots and lots of data on where countries rank. In fact, a new report just came out Monday the 20th, the World Happiness Report. Anyway, he wrote a book called The Geography of Bliss, and he traveled to different countries to try to determine if there was a commonality among happy countries. And one of the countries was Bhutan, and I read the chapter on Bhutan. Was the first time I had ever read the words gross national happiness, and I was immediately taken with that and just said, wow, this is an amazing concept. And what happened in Bhutan, so Bhutan was a monarchy, it isn't now, but it was, and it was an isolated country for many, many years. And then as it was emerging to become more part of the world community, a poor country financially, a reporter asked the king, so what's the GDP of this country? And the king said, I don't care about that so much as I care about the gross national happiness of my people. And honestly, wow, it was like bells and whistles. Absolutely. Why aren't we all doing that? I mean, isn't that really what the role of government should be? To focus on our overall well-being. So the GDP, the gross national product, gross domestic product, is really, it has its place, but it's focused only on one aspect of our lives. And it's just focused on the exchange of money and goods and services. It's not focused on, do we have a beautiful park that we can go and take a walk in when we're sad? Do we have time to do volunteer activities at our church? It doesn't count grandmothers coming and taking time to babysit their grandchildren or grandfathers. I mean, there's so much of our quality of life, all of us, that is not counted when you constantly hear the GDP is this and the GDP is that. There's also a great quote from Robert F. Kennedy, a speech that he gave in 1968, which people can find on YouTube. It's his actual voice. So it's very moving. It's very compelling. And he talks about how GDP measures everything except that which matters most.
Wow.
It's beautiful. So I became very involved in starting a gross national happiness organization. I think the first one of its kind in the country. We had the first ever gross national happiness conference in the United States, and that was in 2010. And through that, then I learned about the science of personal happiness, which solutions that we can aim for instead of staying mired in the negative and the critical. So we are able to see the options for a more positive and hopeful future. And we have, when you cultivate your happiness, you have greater capacity to do the work that's needed. Mm. Greater resilience, greater creativity and problem solving. And at the same time, so personal happiness is important to changing the big picture, but the big picture is also incredibly important because it weighs down on all of us. And no matter what wonderful things are happening or not happening in our own lives, we're still all members of these bigger systems and societies, and we feel the weight of poor decisions. And you know, I'm sure everybody listening can think of sometimes over the last few months when they've felt like it's hard to be personally happy because the outside world is, as you said, pretty tumultuous right,
right.
now.
You know, as you and as you were painting this picture, you were it dawned on me too that one of the questions that has often come up is the matter of if one feels unhappy yourself or feeling somehow deprived, like you aren't getting your fair share or the world's left me behind or whatever it might be, that might be true to some extent.
Absolutely.
That you almost certainly have a very limited capacity to worry about and or want to work for the happiness of others. You have this sort of sense that what about me, and sort of staking your own claim to happiness that you feel is owed to you or that you deserve to experience. And in a sense, there's no room for the bigger picture. And I think what you're suggesting is that one of the blessings of you yourself being happy and grateful and whatever you mean by the word happy, that also, in a sense, makes you interested in and available for and able to work for the happiness for everybody around you as well.
Yes, there's so much in what you just said. And I do, first of all, want to acknowledge, I know there are a lot of people in great pain. There have been members of my own family who have said to me they don't think they can ever be happy. I don't believe that's true. I believe everybody does have that capacity. Even in some pretty terrible circumstances, people can still find the ability to be happy, but it isn't easy. You know, if you're worried about feeding your children, it's hard to be happy. But even people like Christopher Reeve, who became quadriplegic, is able to be happy. Not right away, you know, not right away.
Well, and probably not every moment of every day.
Okay, so nobody is happy every moment of every day. And I'm glad you brought that up because I like to bring that up immediately. I have had my share of crying and troubles. We all do. And one way to think about this is there's something called the positivity ratio. So this is a new science, happiness. The numbers are in dispute. But basically, we all want to aim for a ratio of roughly 3 positive actions, activities, interactions, whatever, 3 positives for every 1 negative in our lives in a day. So that's a lot of negative right there. I mean, it's a given. It's a given. It is part of life. And the happiness movement is never, never about not feeling sad. In fact, I think that the happier we are, the more free we are to feel sad too, because we know it's okay. We know it won't continue. Also, the more we allow ourselves to feel sad, the easier it is to also feel happy.
Hmm. So when you're using the word happy or happiness,
are
you using that term the way most of us use it most of the time? And I ask that because sometimes when people write about this or talk about this or discuss it, they don't really mean happiness in the sort of most normal sense of the word. I have a sense that you really do mean it. I mean, fairly close to what we what most of us think of as happy. But really clarify what you do mean when you use the term.
Also an excellent question, the kind of thing that comes up pretty frequently. I think I do mean it fairly normally. I'm not that kind of esoteric thinker. So the way that I define happiness is a number of words. So I think of it as thriving, flourishing. I think of it as greater peace within, a greater sense of contentment, and also an enhanced capacity to feel positive emotions. So, you know, it's just easier to see that the glass is both half full and half empty, but focus on the half full part and enjoy what's in it. And, you know, so it's pretty normal. It's pretty normal. And so that's personal. In terms of gross national happiness, people often use the term well-being. And so well-being and happiness are interchangeable. And that is used in terms of what kind of government policies, or it could be workplace, it could be any kind of community, what kind of policies can be enacted to best provide the conditions for people's overall well-being. So, you know, how do we protect the environment? How do we nurture relationships? One of the biggest problems in this country, and I don't hear it talked about very much on any kind of policy level, but one of the biggest problems is loneliness. Which causes health problems, et cetera. So how can the government actually create conditions that maybe help people connect better?
Let's talk about a couple of slightly more difficult matters. One of them being, to what extent is it possible to generalize about what makes people happy, given that, at least at a glance, it often seems like what makes me happy is not what makes this person over here happy. I mean, that's, of course, part of what makes us unique and interesting human beings is that we don't all like opera, or we don't all like race car driving, or we don't all like skydiving, or whatever. I mean, we are all different. So, does this get complicated when it comes to, I suppose, particularly on maybe that national level, in terms of you know, if what makes you happy is a walk through the park, and what makes you happy is playing video games all day. Does this get complicated when we think about it in those terms? And how do we wrestle with that complexity?
So I don't think it's complicated to think about it. I think actually putting policies into effect will get complicated. In terms of personal happiness, I like to think of it as being both universal and unique. So yes, we are all different, and at the same time, there has been a lot of research in, you know, really well-known institutions coast to coast in this country and around the world to show that there are certain fundamentals. And in fact, the Surgeon General of the United States, I don't know if he's still the Surgeon General, but a fellow named Vivek Murthy, in December of 2016, he issued a paper saying that happiness is just as important to our health as diet, as stopping smoking, all the things that we think of as being fundamental. He said, so is happiness. And he broke that down into a couple of key areas that seem to really apply to everybody. One of them you already mentioned, which is gratitude. gratitude. I've heard the teachers who've taught me happiness who have said they don't know of any really happy person who doesn't have some kind of a gratitude practice. So gratitude is pretty important. Pretty important. Also, relationships. We all need them. And again, there was a study done on the happiest people and what traits did they share in common. And the one aspect that it seems is really necessary to happiness is relationships. But there's a good example of how we're different. So some people, like my daughter, who you've had here, my daughter is so extroverted. She has so many friends and so many relationships, and that's what serves her. My son is much more introverted, and he doesn't need to have that many people in his life. So you don't have to have, you know, scores of best friends. You can have a couple. But we all need some meaningful relationships.
Connection to somebody.
Connections to somebody. And so the workshop that I'm going to offer on Saturday morning, and really most of the workshops I offer people a variety of science-tested tools and strategies. And I don't expect anybody in the room, myself included, to do them all. I mean, we couldn't. You wouldn't do anything else in your day except work on being happy, and that would not be happy. So there are tools and strategies that work for each one of us, but don't necessarily work for everybody.
Hmm. The other question I really wanted to ask you along this line is that I think when we look at, for instance, the people in our lives or the people that we know, even fairly casually, I think maybe this is especially true of that. I mean, people we see at work or who cross our paths in a fairly peripheral way, but maybe fairly regularly, that it's really easy to think about some people just in general being happier than others, but in a way in which it seems like certain people are just, they seem to be predisposed to being happy, like as though they emerged from the womb a little bit happier than, well, you kind of told a story about yourself sort of along those lines, but just sort of wired to be happy versus others that, for whatever reason, just do not seem to have that same predilection for whatever reason. And, of course, we're also talking about a world in which more and more people seem to be contending with things like depression and so on. How significant a reality is that, what I just described in terms of people's sort of general makeup before they ever even consciously think about being happy or not? And does that make a difference in terms of how this should be approached?
I just love your questions. They're so complex and layered.
Oh, great.
I want to say one thing first, the depression piece. Yes, depression is at a peak. The suicide rate in the United States hit an all-time high last summer, a report
really?
Came out. We're not, I mean, if we look at the GDP is going up, but our happiness is not going up. This might seem to some people like a light and fluffy and fun topic, you know, and it is fun. I am totally serious about this movement, because
right.
we need it. And we need it badly for ourselves and our loved ones and the world around us. So there's that. Yes, mm-hmm. depression is up. And yes, people are born. Some people come out of the womb happier than others. The estimate is that how happy we are or are not is determined by our genes, but only about 50%. So 50%, yeah, we're born that way or born another way. And I always think of Michael J. Fox. He's like, man, he must have been born happy. He just seems so happy.
Well, and still happy despite what he's contending with.
Exactly. Our happiness is not dependent on the trials and tribulations that we face. So, again, new field of study, numbers are fungible, but the belief is that if we have enough food to eat, if we're not in a war zone, then our external circumstances account for about 10% of our happiness. So, you know, do I have a job that I like? Do I feel like I'm in a safe house? Whatever those circumstances are. But about 40% of our happiness is internal work that we do ourselves. It's taking the time for a gratitude practice. It's taking the time to cultivate optimism, which is not a birth trait. People think they were born optimistic or pessimistic. That is not true. So you can cultivate your optimism. You can cultivate your kindness and your generosity and your resilience. All of that can be cultivated. And I have not seen anything in the research that says tools work better or worse depending on how you were born. The tools just work.
And maybe some people need to use them more. Or, is that fair to say?
I hadn't thought of it quite like that ever. That's kind of interesting.
That's maybe a simplistic way to look at it.
But maybe not. Maybe not. Some people probably have to hang in there a little bit longer before they start feeling the effects. But like Martin Seligman, for example, again, he's the grumpy father of positive psychology. He worked with a lot of depressed people, and he used some of these very simple, basic tools with people who were clinically depressed, not just feeling blue, and they showed a distinct improvement over a period of about 3 months till the tools kicked in. So they can work for people who are even feeling like nothing will work for me. It's not true. They can work.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking on The Morning Show with Ginny Sassaman. And if that last name sounds familiar, it may be because Ginny's daughter, Jennifer Sassaman, is a member of the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and has been on The Morning Show any number of times to talk about the productions that she has directed at Parkside. Ginny Sassaman is here all the way from Vermont, in town not only to visit Jennifer and her family, but also to present a workshop this Saturday morning from 9 until 11 at Olympia Brown Church in downtown Racine, a workshop called Self-Care Tools for Stressful Times, and we'll be talking about that in just a couple of minutes. Ginny Sassaman is co-founder and president of the organization Gross National Happiness USA, and also creator of something called the Happiness Paradigm. And it's a really remarkable, beautiful website where you can access all kinds of things, including her blog and lots of resources there about this notion of happiness. Ginny Sassaman, we've already kind of touched on the fact that it is really easy to leap to certain conclusions that are really not correct about, in a sense, the seriousness of all this. I wonder, as you first began exploring this and talking about it and so on, did you do it with any trepidation about being, in a sense, misunderstood about how important this work was and how significant it's supposed to be? Because at a glance, it might seem, as you said earlier, something very, very fluffy and inconsequential and self-involved and, you know, all of it.
No, I had no trepidation. Maybe I should have. But no, because I was immediately taken with this concept of GNH, Gross National Happiness, when I read about Bhutan. And maybe that's because my background, you know, I've also been fairly political my whole life. Starting when I was in about second grade, I remember in my classroom, which was in central Pennsylvania. So this is giving away my age, but I am totally fine with that. I could care less. So we were having a mock election in the Kennedy-Nixon race. And I think there were about 25 kids in that classroom, and 23 voted for Nixon, and two of us voted for Kennedy. So I... But that's never deterred me. I've to see change in the world, to make life better for other people. That's my whole life story. And before I had read about G&H, which was, I first read that in 2009 when I read Eric Weiner's book. I had been really watching the growing income inequality in this country and feeling more and more upset about it and concerned and distressed and, you know, watching, you know, corporate salaries get huge and the workers not keeping pace, that sort of thing. And looking for, well, what can be the answer, because I wasn't seeing any answers. So when I stumbled across G&H, to me, that provides the answer. And I also want to hasten, in case there's anybody out there listening, saying, okay, so flaming liberal, leftist, you know, I am, but the idea is not, and our organization is not. This is a nonpartisan view, and I believe a very unifying view. One of the projects of G&H USA is we have a happiness walk, walking in a big circle all around the country. So far, the walk has gone from Stowe, Vermont, down the east coast of the United States to Jacksonville, turning west, and has gotten as far as the Pacific Ocean. So 4,500 miles so far. And all along the way, we ask everybody we meet who come from all political backgrounds, all socioeconomic backgrounds, races, genders, ages, everybody, what matters most to them in life. And what we find is it's pretty much the same. It doesn't matter whether you were a person who supported Bernie or Hillary or Trump, or if you are a born-again Christian, or if you're Muslim or Jew or nothing, or if you're 10 or if you're 95. People basically all have the same ideas of what brings the happiness to their own lives, to the lives of their loved ones, to their communities. And it's not money. It's not money. So we see this G&H vision as actually having the potential to bring us together as a country.
Wow. Because, of course, there are some drastically different ideas about how we secure these things that all of us have in common as wanting. But it's very easy to focus solely on that and to not see that which binds all of us together. I really understand, too, what you were saying just now about how it really isn't money that makes us happy. Not long ago on Facebook, I saw a meme that I don't even remember now what the photograph was, but the caption of it essentially said, when you're dead and gone, nobody's going to be talking about the beautiful designer high heel shoes you wore, or the beautiful designer couch that was in your living room. No one's going to care about that then. You shouldn't care about that now.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of a reminder that it is very easy to get caught up in the surface stuff that in the immediate moment might seem to bring us gratification and happiness.
Right.
But that isn't the way to really create a fully happy life in the deepest sense of the word.
No. And we do need money for all kinds of reasons. You know, we need money for our health insurance. We need money for our children's education. So it's not like money is the bad guy. Money is just part of the picture. So that's what we're really all about, is including money in a bigger, broader definition of both personal well-being and, you know, community well-being and happiness.
Ginny Sassaman, co-founder of Grow